All right, so this is the first of two classes on the Psalms. And this, the joke in my house is that my favorite psalm is whichever one I'm studying at the moment. And which means that we're studying all of my favorite psalms today. And we'll also be studying all of my favorite psalms next time. But the psalms are a really important part of the messianic picture. And so it's worth spending some time thinking about the book as a whole before we jump into some specific psalms that we want to consider. Our objectives for tonight is that you'll be able to list three useful criteria for determining if a psalm is messianic. Maybe not necessarily authoritative, but they're pretty good criteria, I think. We'll talk about those. Explain how messianic prophecy as a unit, as a kind of an idea that develops through the scriptures, which is the picture we're trying to paint, how it expands in the Psalms. And then to be able to describe how the psalmic view of kingship changes from book 1 to book 5, and then to be able to name the psalm that forms the centerpiece of that transition. If that doesn't make sense, that's fine. We'll talk about that. but I want to start with this question. What would you say is the most important messianic psalm, and why? You don't even have to give me the number if you just want to say, well, the one where it talks about, you know, whatever.
Psalm 22.
Okay. Well, you think that's the most important messianic psalm? I'm not arguing with you. I'm just asking.
That's one of them.
Okay. That is a messianic psalm.
Good. Psalm 110.
Okay. Why would you say that's the most important?
You see the idea of the priest and the king and sitting on his throne after the order of Melchizedek, all of those.
Yeah,
and this is probably just the most quoted
in
the
New Testament. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, Psalm 110 verse 1 is the most quoted Old Testament verse in the New Testament. So that would certainly, that's a pretty good criteria for it being the most important. Good. What else?
Psalm 2 is pretty important.
Okay.
You have no lesson tonight.
Similar, but yeah, and similar images to Psalm 110, slightly different emphasis, but yeah. I'd like you to keep thinking about this question as we go through tonight's class and the class on Sunday. And we'll come back to to more answers, if you have more, towards the end of the next class. But I hope that this question has also raised this thought in your mind: how can I tell if a psalm is messianic? Right? You sort of have to know that before you can decide if it was important or not. So let's ask that question. How would you determine if a psalm... I'm not answering anything tonight. I'm just going to ask. How would you determine if a psalm is messianic? What clues would you look for in the psalm or maybe other places in Scripture to determine if it was messianic?
If a later book says that it is messianic.
Okay. Later books meaning what?
Like a New Testament book quotes it and says it's in reference to...
Good. Yeah, so that's a kind of a slam dunk right there, right? If this was to fulfill the passage which says, Eric.
Well, when you say messianic, what are you meaning by that?
Okay, good. More questions that we have to answer. Yes, excellent. Good. Well,
just ask
the
question. Is
this a you in the 21st century you, or is this a you back in the day? Or?
No, you. Okay. How would all of us, if we were Lindsay, determine if the psalm is messianic? Anything? What else might you look for?
If it was consistent with verses that you've already read, like in 2 Samuel 7:13, that you see repeated, which kind of what she was saying, like with Psalm 10 being repeated over and over again, you also see if it applies backwards, going forward,
or even forward, but not all the way to the New Testament, right? That it's that reuse and reuse idea that we talked about before. So, if an image is described in a psalm and then is later described in Isaiah or in Jeremiah or in Micah as being clearly in that context messianic, then that would change how we go back and read the psalm that also uses that image. Good. So, what I want to do in the next two lessons is to explore the characteristics that suggest that a psalm is messianic. And then see how those psalms help us understand Christ's life and mission more effectively. So in other words, we're not just going to go, here's the verse and here's where it's quoted in the New Testament. I mean, that's important, but it's not nearly as important, I think, as understanding what it, as Eric was asking, what it means for a psalm to be messianic, as a kind of a tool for us to use to read both the Psalms and the New Testament for more than just the places where they quote, where the New Testament quotes the Old Testament. So that's what I want to try to do. We've looked at this slide in many times, and what we're going to see tonight, so we've been for the last few classes in this period, and we're going to go back to that when we talk about Isaiah. But today, we're mostly in this period, and I say mostly because we're actually going to look at some psalms that happen like down here. But
What are you talking about? What are you pointing at?
Sorry, it's the periods of messianic prophecy that we've talked about. So we're mostly going to be talking about the early kingdom period in the Psalms. And I think you'll see by the end of class why I group the Psalms in this early kingdom period. But we are going to look at some Psalms that in terms of date certainly are a part of the later kingdom period. So the major and minor prophets that we've been studying all build on the messianic descriptions in the Psalms. And those messianic descriptions in the Psalms are beginning to tie these isolated images in the Pentateuch into a more cohesive picture. And that's what we'll see in the Psalms. So let's talk a little bit about the place of Psalms in messianic revelation. One of our objectives is to kind of see how messianic revelation changes in the Psalms. And this is really, that's what this is about. The Psalms begin at a moment in Israel's history when the national consciousness, I think, demonstrably shifts to the seed promise, right? So you've got Israel established as a nation, both in terms of numbers and their sort of prominence in the world. In other words, they're not just like a group of people that are hanging out somewhere. They are known among the nations as a nation of their own. So God has fulfilled that promise. Now, does that mean the promise is fully fulfilled, never gets revisited? I don't think so, but certainly they would have seen, well, okay, we're a nation now, so that part of the God's promise is definitely coming to pass. God had given Israel the land, and in the time of Solomon and David, when the Psalms really kind of flourish as an art form, is when the kingdom is at its largest extent. It stretches as far as it ever would. And I think an Israelite living in that time period would have looked at the description of the land that God had promised and looked at what David and Solomon ruled over and gone, yeah, that's pretty good. That's basically what God said that he would give us. And so Israel, I think, now expects that God will begin blessing the earth through them. There are many references in the Psalms to all the nations coming and often in the context of the rule of the king, God subduing nations under me. That's when the king speaks. He often says things like that in the Psalm. And the thing that struck me is that doesn't come from anywhere. There's no precedent for that kind of language or description anywhere earlier in Israel's history than the Psalms. And yet it's there in the very earliest Psalms, even the Psalms attributed to David. And we'll look at one of those next time, which he very clearly uses this language. Well, why is that? I think the answer is that Israel was starting to look for the fulfillment of the seed promise in this time period. And so the references to the nations and subduing peoples are there. It's that view of the Messiah literally ruling the nations that we see kind of the Jews misapplying in the New Testament. I think it starts way back here in Psalms. That view that was how God was going to fulfill the promise of in you all nations of the earth will be blessed. And so this kind of growth of discussion about the Messiah perhaps grows out of this anticipation of God fulfilling that seed promise. And when I say Messiah, I really just mean, I should be more specific in my terms, I really just mean the anointed one. Who is that at this point? We don't really, we don't know. It's in most cases, it's the king. In some cases, it's the sort of descendant of David but the emphasis is on a physical lineage in the Psalms. So when I say the Messiah in the context of Psalms, understand that I'm really talking about just the Anointed One, however the people at the time would have understood it, but probably not in what we would consider a fully Messianic context. It's only when we look back that we can kind of see, oh, here are the Messianic elements in these. But what the Psalms begin to do, at least from our perspective, is to connect the dots of these early Messianic images, and they introduce this three-character description of the Messiah that we often use as a shorthand to sort of summarize what the prophets talk about. And that is the King, which is all through there. We'll look at Psalm 2 as an example of that. The Priest, Psalm 110, is the most obvious example of that, although I think if you're looking for ideas of intercession, rather than specifically priesthood, I think that theme actually runs all the way through the Psalms as well. And the theme of the righteous sufferer, Chester mentioned Psalm 22, that's the sort of clearest example of that in Psalms. But again, that theme runs through the book as well. People suffering even though they've done nothing wrong. And those people calling on God for help and receiving it. So, the other thing that's significant about the Psalms is that they kind of run alongside all of the history and prophecy that we have that covers the nation of Israel as a kind of commentary on what people are thinking about as these events are unfolding, right? So, you know, we know of events in Israel's history from the history books. We know kind of what the general spiritual state was from the prophets. The Psalms give us an insight into what spiritually minded people were thinking about when all those things were happening. When the wicked are prospering because the king is wicked and he's making wicked people prosper. And the psalmist says, why is it that only the wicked prosper and the righteous suffer? There's a context for that, and the Psalms provide us with some of that commentary. And because they cover so much of Israel's history, they contain a record not just of like how they're feeling, but actually of shifts in Israelite thought about lots of things, not least of which is the Messiah and his role, especially the kingship element of that Messiahship. And again, in Psalms, the kingship and Messiah are kind of inextricably linked. But from our perspective, what we're seeing is a change in the way they think about kingship in general that creates a place for the Messiah. And I hope you'll see that as we go through the gospel. Okay. So, let's talk about what it means to be a Messianic psalm. So a Messianic psalm, or a psalm could be Messianic in two. I want to back up. Forget that for a second. You may have heard of like genres of psalms, right? That kind of like they fit into these categories of more or less how the psalmists are feeling, what they're going through, the kinds of thoughts that they express. So you'll probably have heard of like psalms of praise, psalms of lament, imprecatory psalms. We talked about that on a Sunday night not too long ago. Psalms of ascent, these genres where the psalms that are in the genre show sort of similar form and characteristics. Messianic psalms is not a genre, right? Let's just start with that. It's not a genre. And unfortunately, the Messianic psalms are sometimes taught that way, which just ignores the genre elements in each of them. And those genre elements are crucial, and we'll see that tonight. But those genre elements, you can't ignore them and make the Messianic Psalms their own genre. So, what we're looking at then is a psalm that has Messianic characteristics in it. And it can be Messianic in two ways. One is that it directly predicts the actions, thoughts, or words of the Messiah with no reference to the life or circumstances of its rival. And we have examples of this in books of prophecy, right? And we looked at Daniel chapter 7 last time. Like, what did Daniel take away from that vision? Is like, okay, well, here's what I've got to start doing tomorrow. You know what I mean? Or here's how I see God is working right now in my life. That's a vision for the future. It's a vision of what's going to happen years down the road. And Daniel even ends with that message. It's like, seal it up. It's for later. Don't worry about it. Right? some people read Messianic Psalms that way, and I think that's a mistake. I think, again, it ignores the genre elements, and it really cheapens God's revelation to say that these Psalms, which are so often these deeply personal records of what God's people thought and felt during very difficult circumstances, it cheapens them to remove the original writer's experience from the psalm. You need to read it in that context. I would argue you need to read it in that context in order to properly understand the messianic content, and we'll see that tonight. So the other way that a psalm can be messianic is to anticipate the Messiah by recording the writer's actions, thoughts, or words, which are ultimately fulfilled or find their fullest expression in Christ's corresponding actions, thoughts, or words. So, we're not really going to look at Psalm 22 in this class, but the question really boils down to, is Psalm 22 a record of something that actually happened to David? And I think the answer is yes. I think it has to be yes. And it's only when you read it that way, then Christ's use of it on the cross actually can start to make sense. Otherwise, David's just sort of, he's writing these deeply personal things about something that's not deeply personal. And I just have a hard time believing that that God would require that. Those are basically the two ways that a psalm can be messianic. Now, if you take this and kind of stretch it a little bit, you can actually make every psalm in the book messianic in the sense that Christ is the ultimate fulfillment of all of the experiences and difficulties and triumphs and of God's people. There's a sense in which I think that's true, but we need to be careful with kind of going, well, this is clearly talking about Christ doing this or that in his ministry. What we're looking for, as I've said several times already in this class, is not a direct correlation, but a use and reuse, an amplification of something that has come before that can only be fully expressed or understood in the context of what Christ did. Okay, so how do we determine if a psalm is messianic? Three basic criteria, questions you can ask. Does the psalm reference a or the Son of Jehovah? And I put that in there intentionally because sometimes it's not the Son the way we would think of it in a messianic sense. Psalm 2 is an example of that. We'll see. Second one, does the psalm reference David or his descendants? That becomes important because of the promise that God made to David in 2 Samuel 7 about his descendants being on the throne. So if the psalm references David or his descendants, that there's a very, very good chance that it contains messianic elements. And then, of course, the easy one, but a vital one, is the psalm quoted by Jesus or the apostles as messianic? That does require a little bit of effort to determine, are they quoting it to say that it fulfills that, or are they quoting it because it helps them make their point? And that does happen in the New Testament, but we can have that discussion later. But as I said at the beginning, messianic psalms, or psalms with messianic elements, appear in many genres, but they do kind of focus around kingship psalms. This is psalms about kings. Psalms of the earthly king, that would be the descendant of David on the throne in Jerusalem, or not, as we'll see. And psalms of the heavenly king, that's God, right? And this is a very short list. It's basically Psalm 47 and Psalms 93 to 100. Are psalms of the heavenly king. Now, God as the king shows up all through the psalms, but those are the psalms that really focus in on that element. Okay. All right, so here's what we're going to talk about in these classes. This is all introduction, right? Sorry. So we described messianic psalms. We're going to talk about God as Israel's true king and Israel's king as God's son tonight. And those address some of the things we've discussed as features of messianic psalms, the genre, psalms of the heavenly king, psalms of the earthly king, and this messianic feature of reference to A or the Son of Jehovah. Next time we'll look at David the king and the Psalms that are quoted as messianic in the New Testament. Okay, so tonight we're going to talk about God as Israel's king first. So you remember one of the most well-known stories in the Old Testament, Israel rejected God as their king in 1 Samuel chapter 8. God says that, actually God says it, and then Samuel says it again in chapter 10. It reminds the people, you've rejected God as your king, and they say, oh, we did a terrible thing, I think it's in chapter 12, like, oh, we did a terrible thing, we've added, you know, to the iniquity of our fathers by demanding a king, and then they get one, and they sort of say, well, let's do it anyway. Doesn't really make sense. But anyway, Israel rejected God as their king, and their sin, I want us to see, our sin was not, their sin was not having a king. God had planned for them to have a king. He had laws about kingship in the law that he had given them. That was not their sin. The sin was asking for a king, demanding a king. I guess it's kind of similar, those of you with children or with parents, as a conversation you probably experienced that, where as a parent you're thinking, you know, I was going to tell you that you didn't have to do your chores today, and then you whined about having to do your chores. So now giving you the very thing that I wanted you to have anyway now feels like a loss. Feels like I'm losing this battle by giving you the thing I actually wanted to give you, right? And kids, you've probably been on the end of that, where they wanted to give you something, but because of your attitude towards it, suddenly it didn't feel like the thing that was supposed to happen anymore. It felt a little bit like dirty or, you know, not right. I think that's what's going on with Israel rejecting God as their king. He was going to give them a king in his time, but because they demanded it, they sinned. And so, in that context, the king after God's own heart is not just someone with certain moral, personal moral characteristics, although David certainly had those. It's someone who would recognize God's sovereignty, which David did and Saul did not. Saul putting himself effectively in the place of God in many ways throughout his reign, refusing to submit to God. The stories you know. So, that's what God is looking for when he's looking for a king after his own heart. And that's what he says he has found in David. And so, one of the central themes of the Psalms is the re-enthronement of Yahweh as the king of Israel. In Psalm 2, which we'll look at, God invests the king with power and authority. He's not surrendering anything, but I want us to see the book as a narrative. In the beginning of the book, God says, okay, you're the king, you're going to be, I'm going to give you authority and power, and you will rule. In the middle of the book, Psalm 89, the power and authority of that king have vanished. The king's been removed from the throne, the line has been broken, Jerusalem has been destroyed. That person of the earthly king is gone. And by the time you get to the end of the book, Psalm 146, Israel is urged not to trust in princes, but in God. 146, I think it's 3. Do not put your trust in princes, right? So that's the, in terms of kingship, that's the flow of the book, right? And so Israel is wrestling with this concept of God as their king, not the guy who sits on the throne as the king. And so Psalm 74 and Psalm 89, especially when you read them together, but even separately, they describe this crucial transition point in Israel's understanding of God's kingship. So I wish I had done the lesson material a little bit differently. We're going to move through the Psalms in book order, even though that's probably not the order they were written in. So we're going to look at Psalm 2 first, but I want you to see Psalm 74 and Psalm 89 is a really important point in the development of this idea of God as Israel's king. So hold that thought in suspension. We're going to look at Psalm 2 and establish some context for the transition that we'll see in Psalm 74 and Psalm 89. So let's look at Psalm 2. Psalm 2 is probably a coronation psalm with the priest and the king both speaking. If your Bible puts parts of the psalm in quotes, that's because those are the parts where certain people are speaking. God speaks in the psalm. In a coronation scene, presumably the priest would have spoken for God, seeing as he's God's
representative to the people. And then the king speaks, and then the, someone else, maybe the priest, maybe the writer, I'm not really sure, speaks. But you almost get, as you read the psalm, thinking about those quotations, the parts in quotes, you almost like can picture a scene of the king sitting, the king approaching his throne, and when he sits down, you know, he's able to say, I will tell the decree of the Lord. He said to me, you are my son, today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will surely give you the nations as your inheritance. I mean, you can kind of see that as a coronation ceremony embedded in the text. At least I can. If you can't, talk to me, we'll work it out. But I think it's there. So the king then becomes God's son in this psalm. You are my son, today I have begotten you. I would argue he becomes the son of God, a son of God, when he is enthroned. I think that's what Psalm 2 is describing, and I think that is the moment at which that happens. If you look at Psalm 89, 27, there's a similar statement. It may even be a quotation or a reference to this psalm. But he says in verse 27, I will make him, the king, my firstborn, the highest of the kings of the earth. But God says, I will make him that. Well, when is he going to make? He's already alive, or he wouldn't have to make him. He would have been born the highest of the kings of the earth. God says, I will make him the highest of the kings of the earth. We'll come back to that in just a second. But the king becomes God's son when he is enthroned. And then the king God invests the king with his, God's, authority and power to rule over the whole earth in verse 8. Give you the nations as your inheritance, the very ends of the earth as your possession, to judge and administer righteousness, verse 9. That's the ruling them with the rod of iron that is important in the New Testament context. He gives the king the right to receive homage in verse 12. Do homage to the Son that he not become angry and you perish in the way. Right? To receive, effectively, homage in place of God. Right? Not worship, but certainly the honor that would be due to one who is ruling. The king is authorized by God to receive. And, importantly, he's also authorized to administer mercy at the end of verse 12. How blessed are all who take refuge in him. The king does have a responsibility to show mercy, and I think it's significant that the psalm ends with that point. I'm going to pull this into the New Testament in just a second, but before I do that, anything else about this psalm that you observe that you think is important? Did anybody have this as their most important messianic psalm? You did?
No, I didn't. I was going to say that I think it's interesting how it flows from Psalm 1 about the man that meditates on the law of the Lord and is successful in all that he does.
Yeah.
I think they go together because
both
of them talk about actually meditation too. So.
Right. So what I am telling you about Psalm 2 is about this much of the things there are to talk about in Psalm 2. There's like the whole world of stuff, right? And that's one of the most important things is its location in the book and its relationship with Psalm 1. Establishes the tone of the whole book of Psalms.
Well, and, it connects to the law in Deuteronomy 17 about
right.
the king needing to meditate on the law
yep.
and to read
yep.
it and everything. He is that man.
Exactly. Yep.
Why did you emphasize the king becomes God's son when he's enthroned?
Because in Acts 13, Paul applies this verse. Good question. Sorry. No, that's a great question. Here's the answer. Paul applies that phrase, today I have begotten you, to Christ's resurrection, which began his reign. So if you look at Acts 2, that becomes even more explicit. I should read those verses just to make it clear. Now, notice, we're not talking about Jesus becoming God's son when he rose from the dead. That's not what I'm saying. I want to make that clear. We're talking about his kingship. In Acts 2, 32 and 33, Peter says, this Jesus God raised up again, to which we are all witnesses. Therefore, having been exalted to the right hand of God, and having received from the Father the promise of the Holy Spirit, he has poured forth this which you both see and hear. That's kingship language. He has been seated at the right hand of God. He's been made the king as a result of his resurrection, right? And that's what Paul is also saying in Acts 13 when he quotes this verse. And I should have put the verse on there, but I apologize for that. Verse 33. God has fulfilled the promise to our children in that He raised up Jesus, as it was also written in the second Psalm. You are my son, today I have begotten you. So the beginning seems to have clear reference to the resurrection, and the resurrection and the ascension to the throne is what inaugurated Christ's kingship. You can read in 1 Corinthians, there's more about that there, right? The point that I want to make here... Oh, and the other thing is the apostles understood that all of Psalm 2 was about Christ's assumption of rule. You read Acts 4, the prayer that they offer, they basically pray Psalm 2. And part of the point of that is they say that the nations being in uproar, the peoples devising against the vain thing, taking their standing, and the rulers take counsel together in the Lord. They say that's a description of what the rulers did to Jesus. They understand both the context in which a coronation in a physical kingdom would take place. There's uncertainty about who's going to be the king. There's turmoil on the borders as maybe new kings are going to try to move in and take over. In that context, you anoint a king and you say, God has made this king his son. Everything's going to be okay. In the same way, the apostles say, it's exactly what happened here. There was turmoil, there was confusion, there were attempts to undermine God's authority, but God has anointed his son and exalted him to his right hand. So the point really is that, yeah, there are some verses in Psalm 2 that are quoted in the New Testament, but the whole psalm is messianic. And if we just focus on the verses that are quoted in the New Testament to prove that Jesus is the Messiah, we miss great insight into how God's kingdom came into being, which is this pattern that the wicked always reject God. Think of Israel asking for a king. And God establishes his chosen ruler. He puts David in place of Saul. Do you see how that works? This psalm works just as well in the context of David's coronation as it does in the coronation of Christ, or in the coronation of Solomon, or in the coronation of Hezekiah. You see what I'm saying? This is a pattern that we're establishing here, of which Christ is the ultimate expression. And I think that's what we need to see in Psalm 2 and in all of the Messianic Psalms. Okay. We're running out of time, but any responses to that? Have I lost anybody?
So in what sense was Jesus God's Son before His coronation, before His resurrection?
Well, He was the only begotten of the Father, and He's described that way before the resurrection. I think the language in Psalm 2 is about someone who is not the Son of God becoming the Son of God by virtue of His kingship. He becomes the king, and therefore, as the king, He is God's Son. In Jesus, we have the Son of God becoming the king by virtue of His kingship. It kind of reverses the process a little bit. But there is still a coronation process which He has to go through, which is His death and His resurrection and His ascension to the Father. Does that make sense? That's a good question. Okay, so let's talk about Psalm 89 and 74. These are crucial, and I want to make sure we address them. These psalms wrestle with the meaning of the destruction of the temple and of Jerusalem during the Babylonian captivity. You can read, I would encourage you to read Psalm 74 if you haven't done it. It's a very... it's a very graphic description of the destruction of the temple. I don't mean graphic in an inappropriate sense. I just mean he's using really tangible language to describe the destruction of the temple, swinging axes in the sanctuary and things like that. Honestly, to me, Psalm 74 sounds like it was written by somebody who watched the temple be destroyed. It's got that kind of immediacy to it. And so having watched that, you can see why he's wrestling with, what does this mean? Why is God doing this to us? Psalm 89 asks what God is doing since all of the promises to David have failed and His chosen nation has been cast off. Psalm 89 begins with this wonderful soaring praise of God and this beautiful recounting of all the promises to David and everything that God had done in providing for the Davidic line and in disciplining them and in nurturing them. And then really about two-thirds of the way through the psalm, he just says, now you've just cast us off. And then he goes back through and he shows how God has broken, one way of describing it, every single promise he had made to David, right? About there's always going to be someone on your throne. Well, they're gone. The king's dead. There's always going to be, you know, a ruler in Jerusalem. Well, Jerusalem's destroyed. It's a pretty striking psalm if you've not read it to kind of think, okay, that how could you say that? And so the psalmist's conclusion in Psalm 89 is, how long is this going to last? Does God even care that his king has been destroyed and his name is dishonored? That's how it ends. The other thing I want you to see is, if you it's the next page in my Bible, but if you look at the bottom of Psalm 89, you probably see it says Book 4 underneath. For a while, probably for the whole Babylonian captivity, that was the last song in the book. Like, that's how it ends. You know, they always say, end on an upbeat song. They didn't do that. You know? I mean, you kind of want to, like... It's dark. And he's asking hard questions. Because, in some ways, I mean, he's observing things accurately. The Davidic line has been broken. The temple has been destroyed. All of God's promises, including maybe even some of the promises to Abraham, seem to have been broken. Or at least the fulfillment of them has disappeared from sight. The writer of Psalm 89, I think, shares a common view of the Davidic line of promise that because of his promises to David, God is bound to fulfill the seed promise through their physical rule. You see that belief in the New Testament as well, in a slightly different form. But I think the psalmist in Psalm 89, that's the fundamental issue he's wrestling with. You promised God that David's line would rule, and I think the implication is that through them all the nations would be blessed, and that hasn't happened. So that's really depressing. So for a little bit of hope, let's go over to Psalm 74. Psalm 74, as I've already said, addresses the same thing, and in some ways, Psalm 89 sounds like someone already in Babylon, like one of the first wave of deportees who hears about it and is going, you know what this means, right? It means that the Davidic line is over. Psalm 74, as I've said, sounds like somebody who was standing there when it happened. And yet, the psalmist in Psalm 74 offers us a little bit, or offers himself a little bit more hope and comfort in this terrible situation. So he looks back to God's work in creation to remind himself God is powerful, even though he doesn't seem to be working now, he is powerful. And he also references the Abrahamic covenant in verse 20. Consider the covenant. And it's possible he's referring to the Mosaic covenant, but I think it's more likely he's referring to the covenant with Abraham when he says, remember the covenant. In other words, God, remember that you chose us to be your people. I think that's what the psalm is. It is wanting God to remember, because that's the foundation. It's all through the prophets, too. That's the foundation of God delivering his people, is the promise that he made to Abraham. And so the psalmist's conclusion, he's got this wonderful transition. I think about this verse a lot. Verse 12, all these terrible things have happened, verse 11 verses. Verse 12, yet God is my king from of old. That's significant for two reasons. One, obviously, because he is turning to God for hope and comfort in a terrible situation. That's important for all of us. The other thing that's important is he understands, just as well as the writer of Psalm 89 does, that the Davidic line has failed. But who does he call the king? It's not whichever one, Zedekiah, was the last king. It's God. God's the king of Israel. God's always been the king of Israel. He's been the king from of old, right? He's the one that's supposed to be ruling over us. And the fact that we're in this mess is because we rejected his authority. And so, Psalm 74 takes a more comprehensive view of things. It concludes that because of who he is, his work in creation, and his promises, God must still be working to fulfill those promises to Abraham. The land, which has disappeared, the people, which have been scattered, and the seed. that through Abraham's seed all nations of the earth would be blessed. God must still be working on those because of who he is. So, one of our objectives is to identify like the most crucial book in this transition in Israel's view of kingship from the focus on the earthly king and a belief that having the right king on earth was going to fix all their problems to God as the king, which we see in Psalm 146. Psalm 89, I think, is the crucial book in that, or the crucial turning point in the book. Because of its dark outlook, it represents a real low point in Israel's history. It's a time when everything seemed to be, and really was, going wrong. And we have the sort of other side of that, the more, you know, hopeful, optimistic view in Psalm 74. But Israel needed to have the dark moment of Psalm 89 in order to fully realize that God was their king. In order for the conclusion of Psalm 74 to make any sense, you have to have Psalm 89. And so I think Psalm 89 is the most critical book, critical psalm in the flow of the book regarding kingship. Because of how it helps us to see that Israel was forced to trust in God's kingship, not the Davidic kingship. The book of Psalms narrates this transition, really, from beginning to end. And that's why it's significant, I think, that Psalm 89 is book 3, because it's literally that final stamp that says, okay, that's the truth, go deal with it. And to their credit, Israel does. And we see that in Psalm 99. Psalm 99 is part of the Yahweh Malach Psalms, which if you don't speak Hebrew, which I know, can be translated two ways, which are significant for our discussion. It can be translated as Jehovah is king, meaning like he always has been. Or it can be translated Jehovah has become king, which is significant given where these are in the book, except for 47. They are after this low point of Israel's history when Israel is making God king again. Not that he ever wasn't, but they are respecting him, they are honoring him, they are serving him as the king. So God has become king again in Israel. And so he rules as king in Israel in Psalm 99, and that language is really runs all the way through. He's enthroned, but it's not an earthly throne, it's above the cherubim. I mean, that's a reference to a description of an earthly throne, but that's not the point. The point is he's enthroned in heaven. He's in Zion. He rules over all the nations. In contrast to the king in Psalm 2, he doesn't just receive homage. He receives praise as God. He establishes justice and mercy rather than just enforcing it as the king does in Psalm 2. In Psalm 99, God is described as establishing justice and mercy, being the rule setter, the arbiter of what is truly right and wrong. And these verses, I think, are cool. So verses 6 and 7 about Moses and Aaron and Samuel, I think the point, they are figures to help us understand that all of God's ministers in this kingdom are highly qualified and obedient. So he's got the best to serve as his priest and the best to serve as his messengers in Moses and Aaron and Samuel. So this is a kingdom that, unlike the kingdom of Judah, was bound to succeed. But in order for Israel to have these blessings that God intended and promised, God himself had to be their king. As long as Israel placed even the slightest confidence in the actual Davidic line, the physical line reigning on a literal throne, it was going to be impossible for them to see God as their king. It was a set of blinders, because it's right here. It's all I can focus on, and I can't see this larger truth that's out here. So God, in the Babylonian captivity, takes the blinders off so they can see God is my king from the world. By cutting off the Davidic line, at least from the throne, if not from existence, God was helping Israel see who was really the source of their hope. God was their king, and any king God appointed was, at best, a son of God. Christ receives these two offices by coming in the flesh as the only begotten Son of God. After he died, he rose to reign as the King who is God and the Son of God. Since they narrate this important moment of realization about the nature of kingship for Israel, and they make true kingship in Israel something that only Christ can attain, I would argue that Psalms 89 and 74 and 99 are all messianic. even though they're not actually quoted in the New Testament. So it's